From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow marks exactly 50 years since the Beatles released their iconic album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was 1967, just before the Summer of Love. Fans describe the album as intense and reflecting the counterculture the band saw around them. This hour on Point, Sgt. Pepper gets remixed for its golden anniversary. Join us on air or online. Do you remember when you first heard Sgt. Pepper? Do you consider it the greatest album, as many people do? Or do you think it doesn't deserve all its accolades? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Tim Riley. He's an associate professor of digital journalism at Emerson College. He's also the author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary, and also Lennon, the Man, the Myth, the Music. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Good to see you, Sasha.
And with us from New York is Rob Sheffield. He's a writer at Rolling Stone. He has written Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world, and also Love is a Mixtape, Love and Loss, One Song at a Time. Rob, welcome to you also.
Hey, nice to meet you, Sasha.
What I find so interesting about this album is the extremes of opinion you hear about it. There are some people who insist that it's a groundbreaking milestone. Quotes are a decisive moment in the history of Western civilization, a landmark in the history of music, a miraculous metamorphosis. Yet Keith Richards of Rolling Stones called it a mishmash of rubbish. Someone else said an undistinguished collection of work. I think my favorite one is why making records on drugs isn't always a good idea. Tim Riley, would you start us off? What do you think about this album?
Well, I love the record. And I have to say, over the years working on Beatles scholarship, I've grown to love the record and appreciate the record more and more. And this new deluxe edition, this remix, has opened up my ears yet again. One of the great things Rob does in his new book is he talks about how the more we rediscover the Beatles, the more layers we discover, the more they clean up these masterpieces, the more details we hear, and we actually get the continuing sense that we're never going to be able to listen to the bottom of this music. It is going to be continuously rewarding for another 50 years. I think one of the problems with Pepper you have to deal with is the hype. There's a lot of hype surrounding it. And when you write about the Beatles, you immediately run into this problem of hyperbole because they're on such a high level. I don't think it's the greatest album ever made, and I certainly understand why Keith Richards doesn't like this record. But nobody does the follow-up question then, which is, why did you try to make your psychedelic record with Satanic Majesty's Request, which was a bomb? But I do think it's part of – the way I look at it is it's part of this very special middle period Beatle record where you have Rubber Soul, Revolver, and Sgt. Pepper. Those three are of a piece. They do represent like this incredible creative growth in their middle period.
Where they're transitioning from one type of band to another.
That's right. They're transitioning from a dance band and a love song band to something different. Something, you know, what are we going to call it? You'll start getting into controversy the minute you try and figure out what you're going to call it. But we ought to start calling it art at least by now if it's lasted 50 years.
And Rob Sheffield, you are also a fan, I assume?
Yes, I love this record. It's funny that one of the challenges with this record is sort of, as Tim said, there's an awful lot of hype surrounding it historically, and it's a challenge to sort of get beyond the image of the album and get beyond the mystique of the album and actually listen to the music on the album, which has always been a challenge since it's been called the greatest album of all time since even before it was released. And the sort of hype that the record sort of generates around itself, which is part of the excitement of it, but it's a challenge to go beyond that and listen to the actual music on it.
Why were people predicting the greatest album of all time even before it was released?
Well, because there was such a long, suspenseful period of anticipation. They had never spent 5 months working on an album. And the idea that you could just shut yourself off from the world, stop touring, and then devote yourself completely to studio work for such a long time, it was unheard of. It was unprecedented.
This is important context because the Beatles had actually broken up. They had basically said, we're not touring together anymore. Then they went into the studio and had this long gestation period for this album. One of the things I find fascinating about why they decided not to tour anymore is that fans were apparently screaming so loudly at their concerts that they could not hear their own music, and it was becoming very frustrating. So here's a piece of sound from October 1965. The Beatles are arriving at Buckingham Palace to get a big award from, it's called the Members of the Most Honorable Order of the British Empire. And they're not playing music, but their music is playing in the background. This is archival footage featuring a recording of I Feel Fine. So
Tim and Rob, this got maddening to them. Yes, they like their fans, but they was interrupting their art.
Right. Well, we think of this really as the Neanderthal era of stage sound. So it is, they're actually playing very well considering they don't have stage monitors. They cannot hear themselves. They cannot hear their own voices. And one of my favorite stories, it's probably apocryphal, but it's about them showing up at Shea Stadium for one of their two Shea Stadium gigs, 65 or 66. And the stagehand at Shea Stadium says, all right, well, here's your platform and stuff. Go set up over here. And they said, well, we need an outlet. And he said, well, they play guitars, don't they? In other words, the stagehand at Shea Stadium had no clue that they needed to plug in their guitars. That's the era that we're dealing with.
Rob Sheffield, can you talk about that? Those months they spent in the studio as their fans waited for what they expected to be a masterpiece. What was so important about those, that time they spent working on that?
Well, it was the first time in their entire existence as a band, which for all of them meant since the first time since they were teenagers. They weren't rushing to catch a plane. They weren't hiding in a hotel room. I don't think it was so much the onstage experience of playing live that tormented them so much as the constant traveling, the constant rushing, just the physical draining energy of having to play so many shows in such a short time. This is the first time that any band said, we're just going to lock ourselves up in the studio and the record label is not giving us a deadline. It'll be done when we decide it's done. And for any band to work that way, only the Beatles could have done it. And around the world, even before the album was done, people around the world were looking to this album and just assuming that it was going to be the greatest thing ever. There's a great story of Paul McCartney going to visit Brian Wilson in the studio on the West Coast where Brian Wilson is working on Smile, desperately trying to beat Sgt. Pepper into the stores. And Paul sits down at the studio piano and plays a new song for Brian called She's Leaving Home. And then he says, you better hurry up. Like, people around the world are already impatient for this album, looking forward to it, while the songs are still being written and recorded.
Let's hear some music from the album. The second track starts with Ringo Starr. Now, typically Ringo's vocals would fade into the background, but here he gets the lead role. This is With a Little Help from My Friends.
Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help.
Tim Riley of Emerson College, anything special about this one, particularly on this new remixed, remastered album?
Well, yeah, so there's several things to say here. First of all, Ringo does get a single track on every record. He gets a star vocal track, and people forget that. This is probably the most famous one because it is a bit like a mission statement for the band itself, and it's about how they understand that they're much stronger together than any of them are alone. And their solo careers would go on to prove this, but this is a central kind of statement of Beatle utopianism right at the core, right at the beginning of this masterpiece.
Rob Sheffield, I'd like to have you weigh in on some sound as well, because as the album goes on, it gets a little stranger, a little less conventional. It moves to something like the circus theme song that was called Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. So let's listen to that one as well.
The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances in the walls.
Rob Sheffield of Rolling Stone, the sound has clearly changed there. What are we seeing in terms of either evolution, experimentation, a little of both?
Yeah, this is a band that is making music that they know can't be reproduced live. They're just totally giving up on the idea of being a live rock and roll band and trying to create new sounds, not just document what a band could do on stage, but create new sounds in a studio that have never been heard before. And with a song like this, where it was all about atmosphere, John Lennon was famously inspired by a circus poster and told George Martin, I want to be able to smell the sawdust on the floor. And that's what they did with this production.
So what else were they doing experimentally in those several months in the studio? What were they doing differently than they had done in their previous music?
So many experiments, so many ideas. And not all the experiments turned into perfect songs. Sometimes they would have just a sketch of a song, and it was really the performance and the production that turned into the finished creation. But you can hear that they're willing to try anything, and even when they're falling on their faces, there's something about the boyish enthusiasm that they bring to it that's really contagious.
Tim Riley?
Yeah, so the experimentation, of course, had become a big part of their studio work in Revolver. And Rob makes a very important point here. They're busy making songs for tape, even above and beyond making songs. So they're turning into record writers beyond being songwriters. And this business about stopping touring, it's very curious to look back and notice that their set lists in 1966 did not include any tracks from Revolver. So they're already sort of making this transition in their heads anyway. The curious thing that I note about the recording sessions for Sgt. Pepper is how completely immersed they are in the studio concept, even as they start recording. So we have this fantastic, the outtake discs on the deluxe box set version. You hear them taping master tracks for the songs where you can hear them imagining the completed version of the songs, even as they're playing just the most rudimentary parts of it. And that's really, really interesting.
We got a Facebook comment from a listener, Chris Tucker, who said, I was nearly a teen. He's referring to when the album came out. So my mom drove me to the record store to get it. I played it until there were no grooves left on the LP. a great bidated reference. We're discussing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Beatles album is 50 years old this week. Join the conversation. Let us know what your favorite tracks are. Do you think it's the greatest ever? Do you think it's overrated? What stands out to you and why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We go out with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. This is from the new Sgt. Pepper, Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band Anniversary Edition. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're listening to new remixes of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. It was just released in honor of the album's 50th anniversary, and right now we're hearing the song Getting Better. Join this conversation. Let us know what stands out to you from this record. If it came out when you were young, what kind of impression did it make on you? Do you consider this a concept album, as it's called? Do you consider it the Beatles' best album? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Tim Riley is with me here in the studio. He's a journalism professor at Emerson College and author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary, and Lennon, The Man, the Myth, the Music. Also with us from New York is Rob Sheffield, a writer at Rolling Stone. He wrote Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. We have numerous callers, Tim and Rob, who would like to weigh in on this, so let's go to them right away. First, Cindy, calling from Springfield, Illinois. Cindy, welcome to On Point. Tell us what you think of the Beatles, and in particular, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was the very first CD when they came out remastered a few years back that I went and grabbed. Probably because it was a concept album and I was only 7 when it was released, and I had all the 45s from when I was 4 years old, and my mom didn't like the Beatles at all. But I think that's why it was kind of, because it was an album and there weren't a lot of 45s that were released off of it that were quote-unquote proper for me. So it was my forbidden album. So the forbidden fruit is always the first thing you go to grab.
And did your mom ever tell you why she didn't like it?
She just didn't like the Beatles. And I believe it could have been after, you know, the whole Lennon thing with the Christ and everything. But my feed in on why they changed is they had a bunch of songs written when they were young. And those were all on their early albums. And they were very young, happy, poppy little tunes. But when George started writing and they started collaborating all together and George brought his tunes in, that's, to me, when everything changed.
Cindy, thank you for that. Let's hear from another caller. This is Nick from Rockland, Maine. Nick, welcome to On Point and your take on Sgt. Pepper.
Well, first, if I could just say I was very young when the Beatles started out and I was following their career as an 8-year-old up. And you just never knew what you knew. Every year they're going to come out with an album. You didn't know exactly what it was going to be like. A second point is some of their very best songs. They weren't like "Happiness Is a Warm Gun" or anything like that. They're only 2.5 minutes long. Today, a song like that would be 6 minutes long. They just pad it out. When the Beatles are making songs, almost all of them were under 3 minutes, and they're so brilliant. As for Sgt. Pepper, that is, as many people know, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane were part of that session, and they were going so over that the Beatles and George Martin threw EMI, the recording company, a bone as a single. For my money, it is the best single in rock and roll history. It shows more range and talent on a single than most bands have in their career, and yet it's the only single not to have made number one. The position was being held at the time by Engelbert Humperdinck.
Nick, let me have Tim Riley jump in for a minute, because there's an interesting footnote there about why Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane were not included on the original Sgt. Pepper. Tim Riley, can you tell us what happened there?
Well, no, the story the caller tells is true. The record company came to the Beatles in February of 1967 and said, "You haven't had product in over 5 months, you know, and we just have never gone that long, and the audience is going to forget who you are, and your career is just going to nosedive unless you put something out." And they sort of put their foot down and made the Beatles do it. So one of the parlor games that Beatle people like to play is, if Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane had been put on Sgt. Pepper, how would that change the album? And obviously it would make it a very, very different record, because those are two very big songs. What I like to think about is they had four songs by February. They had When I'm 64, Day in the Life, Penny Lane, and Strawberry Fields Forever. So they chose the two songs about Liverpool to put out as a single, which is a genius idea, because it's John's view of childhood on one side and Paul's view of childhood on the other side. But then you realize that the two tracks that they started with for Pepper are a mid-track side two, When I'm 64, and the finale. So they had to reverse engineer the entire album from those two songs.
That's very interesting. Let's listen to a little bit of Strawberry Fields Forever. Again, recorded during the Sgt. Pepper sessions, but ended up being released separately. They essentially sacrificed them to commercial pressure. Here's Strawberry Fields Forever.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever.
Rob Sheffield of Rolling Stone, as you analyze that song, what do we learn from this one?
It's just an amazingly blunt and stark song, rooted in John's childhood memories of Liverpool. Something I love about Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, which, is, as Tim said, have always been linked together, is that John writes this song about Liverpool. Paul hears it. Paul flips out, says, "Hey, what a great idea." Comes back a couple days later with Penny Lane, which is another song about their childhood in Liverpool. And just such a beautiful example of how John and Paul played off each other, that even though they didn't write these songs together, they wrote them because they were playing off each other and competing with each other.
One of the interesting things to me about this album is why it can be difficult to explain to people who were born decades after it came out why it was such a big deal when it did come out. In fact, just today, the New York Times has a piece about this, about Sgt. Pepper, the new album, saying, "We simply cannot hear it now, the way it affected listeners in Arrival in 1967. Rob Sheffield, put us in the context of 1967, both musically and culturally, and why this felt like such a phenom.
Well, music is changing in such large part because of the Beatles, but bands are starting to stretch out more and experiment more. The Beatles set the standard with albums like Rubber Soul and Revolver, which other artists hear, and instantly they're trying to top them. So, you know, in 1966 alone, you have Bob Dylan putting out Blonde on Blonde, you have the Beach Boys putting out Pet Sounds, you have the Rolling Stones doing Aftermath and the Kinks doing Face to Face, and you've all this groundbreaking music from Marvin Gaye and Otis Redding and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Byrds and the Mamas and the Papas, and all this music worldwide is sort of rising to the challenge that the Beatles set down. And so for the Beatles to take, as Tim pointed out, an unprecedentedly long time off making this album people around the world thought, what are they doing in their laboratory that is going to come out and make everything else that we're doing look silly? So the sort of anticipation that was built up to the release date is something that was unprecedented.
Oh, the laboratory. I love that term. There's another song that really speaks to how experimental they were being, a very, very much a departure from their traditional sound. And that's when they used a sitar, the stringed instrument that you usually hear with Hindustani music or Indian classical music. And it gets really emphasized on George Harrison's Within You, Without You. Let's listen to that.
With our love, with our love, we could save the world if they only knew.
Tim Riley sounds a bit like a totally different band.
Well, yes, it does. And that's one of the extraordinary ways that they're expanding their range. Now, their range. Now, they had used sitars before, right? Sitars show up on Norwegian wood. Rubber Soul. But this is the first Beatle track to use exclusively Indian instruments. So there's no rock and roll underlying this strange new sounds that we're hearing to sort of orient the listener. So that was a big departure. I always sort of not been very fond of this song, but a couple of years ago, Patti Smith recorded a cover of this song, and it made me hear it in a completely different light. And I recommend that record very highly. It's a record called 12, I think, and it's Patti Smith doing a bunch of covers of different things. And she actually made me hear this song anew.
Let's listen. Let's go to another caller. This is Omar calling from Savannah. Omar, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think as you hear this conversation.
Well, good morning. I think at that time in the music industry, a lot of bands, artists, sort of their music reflected their experience and what was happening in the world. And the Beatles, along with some other artists, Bowie, The Who, would sort of, their songwriting would reflect that. And, you know, and it goes back to a time when every song, as far as fans were, every song was a hit. And not like today's albums, you get one hit, the rest is B-side or whatever it's called today. So it was a very exciting time and people just anticipated the music. I don't know if they do it now, but back then, as far as my experience, all of myself and my friends just eagerly awaited these albums because of that point, that it was reflective of the times.
Omar, thank you for that. Let's go to Jep, who is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Jep, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. I'm calling just to say two things. Sgt. Pepper was the first Beatles album I bought. I bought it when I was 15. Before that, I'd been dismissive of them because it seemed like sort of girls liked them and screamed. And when this came out and I heard it, I thought, oh, my God, this is really the real deal. Then the second, I saw a documentary about an hour long, several years ago, of the making of Sgt. Pepper, and it really detailed all that George Martin had done, which is really extraordinary because of the recording.
This was the album's original producer.
Yeah,
and his son, by the way, I believe, has produced this remix album.
Right, right. So it just was astonishing what he was able to do, sort of translating their ideas and visions into actual tracks.
Jep, thank you for that. Rob Sheffield, we've heard people talk about this music being reflective of the times. Can you talk more about the cultural context? Because as we said, it was the so-called summer of love. It was the height of hippie culture. It was the Vietnam War. Beyond just the Beatles growing, maturing, evolving, how much was the outside world influencing their music?
Well, intensely, partly because there was this giant youth audience for this kind of music that the Beatles had sort of conjured into being. And they're very upfront about their countercultural affinities on the album. You can see that in the fact that there's a row of pot plants on the cover, which was another innovation that nobody else could have gotten away with. And even something like the cover with all those disembodied faces from all over history. And there's something really flamboyant and charismatic about it. And the Beatles are speaking to this Summer of Love audience and speaking as the Beatles.
There's one song on the album that has had mixed reviews over the years. John Lennon himself once called it, quote, a throwaway piece of garbage. It was a song inspired by a TV commercial for Kellogg's Corn Flakes. Tim, I understand that you disagree with John's dismissive take on this song. So let's listen to the song and then tell us what you think. It's called Good Morning, Good Morning.
Go to a show, you hope she goes. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
So Tim Riley of Emerson College, John Lennon himself did not like that. Why do you?
Well, John Lennon was not always the best judge of his own material, like a lot of artists. So I don't have any problem with him saying. And he said a lot of weird stuff about a lot of his material, talking about stuff as just a piece of junk and a throwaway and stuff. And I think there, on some level, maybe he wasn't happy with the final track or the final mix or whatever it was. For whatever, I would have liked to have pressed him on that. But I hear Good Morning, Good Morning as a really fantastically insightful and snarky kind of take on modern man and a person kind of having a psychotic break and drowning in commercial culture. And so that this repeated good morning, good morning, good becomes kind of a taunt, and it sours on him, and you kind of feel him kind of falling down this some kind of hole and having no, you know, all the normal parameters, the signposts of life, school and work and tea time, all just kind of slipping away from him and having no meaning. And I hear it as a kind of an anticipation of the dislocation of A Day in the Life.
We have a caller from Lakewood Ranch, Florida. This is Jess. Jess, your thoughts on the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper?
Oh, hi, Sasha. Thank you. It's one of my favorite records of all time, frankly. I'm only 30, and I heard you mention earlier that, you know, some people my age aren't quite aware of the impact that record had, but, I read a lot of guitar magazines and everything, and, I read that it came out on a Friday, and by Monday, Jimi Hendrix was playing parts of it on stage. And I know that they made some remarkable innovations in as far as engineering albums goes during that time, and it's held up. It's one of my favorites.
Thanks for that, Rob Sheffield. Did this album raise the bar for other musicians in terms of what they felt like they should reach for and how they should be experimental?
Yes, it really changed for artists who were trying to catch up with what the Beatles had done a couple years earlier. It was a real revelation, and you could see that impact all over the place. You know, someone like Stevie Wonder hears this record and says, "Hey, you know, they're doing this album where they're not trying to reproduce a stage show. They're playing all the instruments themselves, overdubbing it." Stevie Wonder gets the idea to do an album like Music of My Mind and Talking Book, the idea that he could make these albums himself, overdubbing all the instruments. For someone like Marvin Gaye, it was an idea to do something like What's Going On with just one long statement. And artists from every style of music and every corner of the world just responded to the Beatles' challenge.
We have another caller from Rapid City, South Dakota. This is John. And John, your thoughts about Sgt. Pepper?
Hi, Sasha. So many salient points being made. I see this album as the perfect storm. The Beatles had hit their stride as individuals and as a band, and right at the time that they had the leverage on their label because of their saleability, that they were able to just make incredible strides. And then at the point in time that there was so much available, in the record stores, I mean, so many kids had money in their pockets that it was all a perfect storm. And consequently, I just cannot listen to a single track on Sgt. Pepper. It's the album or nothing.
Mm, thanks for that. That reminds me that, Rob, I believe you've said that you think Sgt. Pepper invented the album culture. Tim Riley, do you agree with that? And what does that mean exactly?
Well, definitely, yes. So it's a concept album. What do we mean when we say that? It means that every single song and the way the songs are sequenced makes more sense than any song does all by itself. So when you hear someone else sing with a little help from my friends, you think, oh, what a cool song. When you hear Ringo sing it on the Sgt. Pepper album, you understand it's song two and that you're on this journey and you're going to travel through side one, through side two, and it's part of a larger piece of a sequencing that's going to take you somewhere.
So you could listen to the songs individually, but you'd be missing out on what they're trying to, the message they're trying
that's
to send.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons they erase the silence between the songs for the first time on this record. Every time a song comes to an end, a new song starts without the typical 2 seconds of silence between tracks.
We're discussing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Tomorrow marks exactly 50 years since the album was released, and we're listening to the new remixed version. Join this conversation. Tell us if you remember listening it for the first time. Has it grown on you over the years? Did you appreciate it from the get-go? Has it never been that great for you? We go out with She's Leaving Home, again from the new Anniversary Edition. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
How could she do this to me? She
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're listening to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band remixes, just out in honor of the 50th anniversary of the album. Join this conversation. Tell us which songs from this album made the biggest impact on you. How do you try to explain to newer, younger generations why this music was a big deal when it came out in the late 60s? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're hearing an outtake of the song Fixing a Hole from the new Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band Anniversary Edition. With me in the studio is Tim Riley, a journalism professor at Emerson College and author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary, and Lennon, the man, the myth, the music. Also with us from New York, Rob Sheffield, a writer at Rolling Stone. He's the author of Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. Tim and Rob, in terms of how younger people can try to understand why this album was so influential when it came out, I read something that said, take the appeal of Harry Potter today or recently and then multiply it times a million in the 1960s. Rob Sheffield, do you think that's a fair way to try to size it up?
I love that. It's an album that it's traveled well through time. Partly, it sounds more like a hip-hop album structurally than a rock album, that it has sort of the cut-and-paste aesthetic that came into vogue with sample-based producers like Prince Paul or the RZA. The fact that there's something about the sort of cut-up montage effect of the songs that makes it flow really more like a hip-hop record.
Tim Riley, you said earlier in the hour that the more you listen, the more it means to you. And yeah. there was actually a critic early on that didn't like it very much and has since acknowledged that he appreciates it more now. He said, I didn't get it because the record wasn't really rock. It didn't belong in any genre that I could think of. So I didn't know how to receive it. It challenged people.
Yes, it did challenge people. And, you know, the world was poised to fall in love with this record. It was kind of a perfect alignment of stars. And I think you're referring to Richard Goldstein, who wrote a very famous pan of the record in the New York Times. And he's a terrific critic. He's one of the earliest rock critics. And I've talked to him about this issue. And I think there was a piece for him of trying to press up against that mass, that unanimity of deciding this was a great record even before people heard it. And he was trying to point out, look, this is not really a rock and roll record. And he was right, but he's also right that he wasn't really prepared for what it was. The other analogy I like to draw is we really haven't had anything like the Beatles since the Beatles. And it's a remarkable achievement because they were creating at a very high poetic level. Everyone understood that aesthetically they were working as artists, or at least a lot of listeners understood this, even if the older generation wanted to dismiss it. But they were also massively popular. And you just do not get that combination of great artistry and mass acceptance at the same time as it's happening. That just doesn't happen very often. When it does happen, it's really exciting. But I'm not prepared to call Harry Potter art yet. But it is the closest thing we have to a mass embrace of a piece of literature, of a long piece of storytelling. And it takes a lot of attention, takes time, right? You have to spend time with this material in order to appreciate it. It's the closest analogy we have.
Rob Sheffield, I came across a random online comment on a Salon story about Sgt. Pepper that I think sums up nicely what the Beatles seem to have been trying to do. And the commenter wrote that Sgt. Pepper album was a message from the Beatles to the fans saying, hey, join our army of anything is possible. And that seems to be what they've done. They threw in horns and chamber music and sitar and R&B. They wanted to rethink what they were capable of and what they were perceived as.
Absolutely. And that really comes out in the new anniversary edition with all the outtakes and all the different approaches they took to these songs. You could just hear how fast they're moving through all these ideas and all these experiments, that they're not saying every experiment has to turn out to be gold. They're saying, listen to this, get inspired, do your own thing, make your own version of this in your life, whatever it happens to be, but just try these ideas.
Let's listen to a song on the album that speaks to what we talked about earlier in terms of the band transitioning from a touring band that went out and did concerts to one that really just wanted to do its thing in the studio and not have to please a mass market necessarily. This is the closing track on Sgt. Pepper, often considered one of the most celebrated. It's called A Day in the Life. It ends quite dramatically. Let's listen to this. Tim Riley, is that noteworthy to you?
Oh, it's very noteworthy because it's deeply ironic. It's the final chord of the album, the final chord of the song. The song is a very dark rumination on the modern world that we go back to after we go to a show. It's the morning after song. Our narrator has woken up and he's reading the paper and he's very, very depressed about the events he's reading about in the paper. This is the other part of the context of Pepper that's very important. It was Summer of Love. It was Flower Power. But it was also the year of the Six-Day War. And if you were 18, you were getting shipped off to Vietnam. So the darkness of the 60s that gets discarded when people try and paint it with a very broad brush, that is here on this record too. And it's really about, okay, so now we have this beautiful fantasy world we've built. Well, what does it count for? What does it mean? How do we then take it back into our real lives? That's what Day in the Life is about. That final chord is very disturbing. It's got a kind of hollowness to it. It is not decisive. It is not conclusive. It is very open-ended and ambivalent, and it's deeply, deeply distressing.
Let's not leave that song yet, because we heard that chord, which is done with pianos.
Right.
Rob Sheffield of Rolling Stone, the remix has a very different ending. Let's listen to that. They're humming. Rob Sheffield, what do you think about that?
Very different. I went to Abbey Road to listen to the outtakes a couple months ago.
The studio in London. The studio in London.
Yes. The studio in London, and Giles Martin, who supervised this reissue, he was playing me some of the outtakes. When he played me that, I laughed so hard, I literally fell off my chair. And I said, it's really funny that they're going for the same sort of big dramatic ending with this big sustained chord, but it's very different when they overdub themselves humming and turn themselves into a choir. It's almost a happy sort of sound, which is very different from the piano sound that they ended up going for. That final chord with the piano crashing, that was always too scary for me to listen to as a kid. I would sit by the vinyl and I would lift the needle. When I would listen to the Blue album, which had that song, and then it went into All You Need Is Love, and I'd always try to lift the needle to get to the beginning of All You Need Is Love, skipping that chord because it just scared me.
Scary.
Tim,
yeah.
you're nodding.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that they include this outtake. We knew that this was one suggested ending, but it shows how willing they were to try things, right? This is kind of a ridiculous idea when you say, all right, let's just finish with all of us humming the word and the recorded result is not very successful, but that the fact that they went and actually tried it actually tells you a great deal, and that they were willing to try it and then willing to just say, all right, that didn't work, now what? And it led them to the right ending. But what was much more disturbing and much more distressing an ending, much more powerful, dramatic, much more impactful.
Let's go to a caller from Ellsworth, Maine. This is Peter. Peter, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think of the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper.
Thank you, Sasha. Well, I love the album, and I remember it very well because I was a schoolboy in Sevenoaks, Kent, England, in February of 1967. And one day, a boy rushed into school and said, "Oi, the Beatles are in Knoll Park," which is a large park right next to the school. And about 20 of us rushed out and down into the park, and the Beatles were there with a small film crew filming, as they were no longer performing live, a piece of film to go with that release of Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. So we watched them film, and they were extremely accessible. There was no kind of security at all, as we would expect today. We were talking with them, and the only time we were told to get out of the way would be the director might say, "Oi, lads, you're in the shot. Move off, please." And it was an extraordinary experience. It was during the time that they were filming Sergeant Pepper. They were like gods to us, of course, and they were incredibly nice to us, incredibly sweet, and, you know, giving us their time. And it was on that trip down to Sevenoaks, John Lennon's Rolls Royce, painted like a gypsy caravan, was parked nearby. It was on that trip that he was poking through an antique shop nearby, in a town nearby, and he found the poster that inspired For the Benefit of Mr. Kite. So that's just my little piece of anecdotal history, but it was a magical time, and I remember it vividly.
Thank you for that, Peter. Let's go to Nancy calling from Troy, Alabama. Nancy, what do you think of the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper?
Hi, Sasha. I heard it as a child when I was 6 or 7. My mother had the album, and we had the poster right next to the Simon and Garfunkel poster, and I would play and listen to it all the time, and I knew all the words, and, you know, through my innocence, I didn't know anything about the concept of the lyrics, but I could sing along with all of it. But I enjoyed the depth of the music, and the sitar became my favorite. Just, I thought it was so magic, and it would make me cry and just take me away to places. And by listening to this conversation, I realized, well, that explains why now my go-to music is Armenian and Pashtun and sitar music still to this day.
Ah, you think the influence of childhood through the Beatles made you like that kind of sound?
Yeah.
Well, you know what else is interesting about that is that, Tim and Rob, we have a case here where someone wasn't listening to the lyrics, and of course, or at least understanding what the lyrics were meant to be from an adult perspective. And of course, if you do understand the lyrics, you have a deeper meaning, but simply the sound alone was a great pleasure for this person. So you can appreciate it on two levels.
Oh, totally. I mean, one of the great pleasures of Beatle music is going to any single Beatle track and just tuning into the bass line. And Paul McCartney, I think Paul McCartney's greatest contribution to rock and roll is actually his bass playing. And you can just take enormous pleasure just from understanding how Paul McCartney is orienting that bass line into the rest of the track. He often went in and did it after the master track was made so he could contribute a more melodic bass line. But yes, you can take any single layer of a Beatle track and find pleasure in it. And of course, that's what kids would do too, yeah.
Let's hear from Bruce, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Bruce, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Sasha. And this is a brilliant hour you and your guests are having here. I listened to Sgt. Pepper first in summer school and college, and it quickly became apparent that this was more than just a record, a rock and roll record. There was something more to it, and you couldn't really put your finger on it, but there was something more there, and it required more of you. And that's why we're still talking about it. I'm reading Eric Kandel's Reductionism of Art and Brain Science. Saw him on Charlie Rose. And the point that he makes for abstract art is it takes more work by your brain.
What do you think this album requires of the brain?
Enjoy it. Pardon me?
What do you think this album requires of the brain?
It requires more thought. If you're to just establish a relationship, a true, deeper relationship with it, you have to contemplate, and you also have to just open your emotions without thinking. It's both of those things. And you have to do that with Sgt. Pepper if you're really going to try to comprehend it.
Thank you for that. Let's go to John, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. John, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts about this music?
Hi, Sasha. I teach at Brookline Music School, and we have a program called the Beatles Summer Project, where we perform Beatles albums live from beginning to end. And, of course, we're doing Sgt. Pepper this year on August 6th at the Coolidge Corner Theater. But the larger point is that Beatles albums can unite a community unlike any other artists, I believe. And there's literally something for everybody because of the huge diversity of the tracks. Beatles music is not necessarily technically difficult to play, so you don't have to be a professional musician to do a good job at it. And there's a never-ending debate among Beatles fans about which is the best Beatles album. And there's a lot of arguments that Sgt. Pepper isn't the best. It's not necessarily the best in terms of the quality of the songs, but it is by far much, much greater than the sum of its parts. And so I'm going to have to vote for Sgt. Pepper.
Thanks for that, John. Rob Sheffield, John made an interesting comment about the uniting power of the Beatles. Do you see it that way? Is there something that no matter what age or generation, I mean, it's hard to say that any music could unite everyone. Do you think this album has that potential?
Well, absolutely. The Beatles in general are just such a bizarre case of this band just transcending what anybody would have predicted in terms of their ability to appeal to all generations, all cultures, all personality types. And Sgt. Pepper being in many ways the most Beatle-y of Beatle records, because it's the one where they just most indulge themselves to chase their fantasies to the utmost limit. I love what Tim said about this album, that you can hear them imagining in this music, and that's really what it is, and I think it's why it unites people the way it does.
And its popularity does seem to endure. I read that on Spotify alone, about 10 million people still listen to the Beatles every month, and the re-released album this week may end up hitting number one on the sales charts in the UK. So it's quite amazing about how enduring it is.
Yeah, well, Rob makes this great point in his book about how when they released the Beatles' greatest hits album called One, which was just a series of number one singles by the Beatles, and everyone thought, well, why does this record need to exist? We all have this. It's all out there before, but this package wound up outselling everything else and became like the biggest album of their career. And Rob's point was, you know, it made us realize, oh, the Beatles are even greater than we suspected, because you put out a record like this, and it turns out, oh yeah, they're even better than we thought. Yeah.
That's great. Tim Riley is a journalism professor at Emerson College. He's also the author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary, and Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Music. Tim, thank you for coming into the studio.
My pleasure, Sasha.
And Rob Sheffield of Rolling Stone, thank you for joining us from New York. He's the author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World, and Love is a Mixtape, Love and Loss, One Song at a Time. Rob, thanks to you, too.
Thank you so much.
And to all our listeners, please continue this conversation online. You can go to onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And you can get the OnPoint podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to go out with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band reprise from the new Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band Anniversary Edition album on this 50th anniversary this week. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.